So, this month, it's a survey of the pregnant parameter literature. There are about 40 different sutras in the corpus, in the body of work. And they all comprise the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma, which centered on the perfection of wisdom as the beginning of the second turning. They appeared between, say, 100 BC and 600 AD. And the first one apparently was a long poem, the verses of the Ratna Samuchaya Gatha. And it paralleled the Ashta Sahasrika, the perfection of wisdom, in 8,000 lines. So the Ashta and the Ratna Samuchaya appeared about the same time, and they had pretty much all the essentials of the perfect wisdom teachings contained in them. And then there's a version in 10,000 lines, in 18,000 lines, 25,000 lines, and then perfection of wisdom in 100,000 lines. And after that, then they started summarizing them with smaller sutras. The most famous of those are the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra that we just chanted. Then after that, or parallel with that, some of the sutra, tantric sutras also appeared. And these have tantric ideas in them, as well as mantras and dharanis. Now the sutras all presuppose a deep understanding of the emptiness of a personal self, of an ego, because that's the teaching of the first turning. They posit instead an impersonal process of five skandhas, and these five skandhas rise and fall every moment. A moment is a finger snap, a 10,000th of a second or so. So it's very hard to see these skandhas rise and fall, but it's possible to view them in their continuity. And they're really heaps of these dharmas, which are the atoms of experience. So that each moment, a cluster of these dharmas arises, and that determines the experience of that moment. And then they dissolve again, and a new cluster arises, usually a very similar cluster to the previous one. So that there's an illusion of continuity. But actually, the mind stream is moment by moment by moment. And if you practice mindfulness and meditation, you probably notice that some moments are missing because we've been asleep during them. And some of them were on automatic behavior and we're only dimly aware of what we're doing. And that's a condition that doesn't go away. At least not in my experience. Maybe eventually, way up the line, it goes away or transmutes. But all we can do is notice those states of mind as they come and go. And that's the rising and falling of the skandhas. And they're constrained according to the laws of cause and effect. Basically, our experience is a projection of our own mind, the way we experience things. Irrespective of what actually goes on in the outside world, our reaction to it, our experience of it, our tendency to draw to us those experiences that accord with our state of mind. The good news there is if we change our state of mind, then we change our experience. So it's possible to clear up obstacles, internal obstacles, and then the the state of the mind changes, and the result is life gets better. So that can happen to us, hopefully often. Okay, all of these skandhas then, in the Perfect Wisdom Sutras, are declared to have no intrinsic existence. They have no essential nature, no own being, as it's called, svabhava. in the previous turning, it was said that every dharma has a svabhava. It has a mark that you can recognize it by. These svabhavas were considered to be real attributes of really existing things, namely the dharmas. When the second turning started, the Perfect Wisdom Sutras turned all that upside down and said, no, these dharmas themselves are also empty of any intrinsic nature. They're not real. They're not like billiard balls or atoms. They appear, but they have no substance because they come and go. Anything with substance would endure. So even a mountain, which seems to have substance and endure for a long time, eventually wears away. And a whole continent re-arises, and then the mountains reappear again. So it works on every scale of manifestation. But the one we're interested in, of course, is the psychological scale. And we can use the five skandhas as an approximate way to view the process of the mind without there being any self. It's that the thinking mind goes on, the subconscious motivations, the virtuous and non-virtuous impulses continually take place, the apparatus of sense perception and the recognition of a sense object, all that takes place, the feeling reaction to the sense perception, so we either like it or we don't like it, or we don't care. We're neutral. And this neutrality is not the same as equanimity, which you could call something like sublime indifference. But it's a neutral state of simply not caring. So those are the three feeling tones that you get in reaction to a sense perception. And then all the other stuff in our minds are built on that scaffolding. So all the emotions that we have are complex variations of these three reactions, a positive, negative, or neutral reaction to a sense perception. So those are the five skandhas, and it's easier to observe them individually than try to observe all five at once. You know, you can concentrate on the perceptions, or concentrate on the sense contact, or concentrate on the thinking mind, on the dualistic mind, and observe it. You know, you have to have some distance from what you're observing. But you can observe all those skandhas separately. I've never had much luck observing them all working simultaneously, but they do. It's like a constant process. Yeah. There's form, which is the appearance to the senses. There's feeling, which is the reaction to the sense contact. There's perception, which I called recognition, though I'd now change it back to perception. But it's the entire field of perception from the sense contact all the way up to recognition of an object and naming it. Which is exactly why it's called both perception and recognition. And then the difficult one is the fourth skandha. That's the impulses or karmic formations. And then the fifth one is the dualistic mind, the thinking mind. Yeah,
mind.
Yeah, not to awareness itself, but to the dualistic mind.
Okay.
Because awareness is not thinking.
Okay.
So that's a different dimension.
And the skandhas are about thinking.
The fifth skandha is, yes.
Okay. But do the same skandhas is the same thing as aggregates?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Karmic formations. Oh, impulses and aggregates, yeah.
But why is impulse and karmic formation?
That's actually the fourth skanda. I misspoke.
Yes. But how, why are those the same? Karmic formation and impulses.
Well, the Sanskrit word is samskaras, which literally means putting it together. And it involves something like 50 different kinds of dharmas. There are wholesome states, unwholesome states, and neutral states. And any of these karmic formations, any of these impulses, can arise in a moment and condition what you experience and what you do in that moment. So karmic formation seems a little bit too static. And impulses isn't exactly right either. But that's the idea. They're the things in the subconscious that motivate us, usually automatically. But there are also virtuous dharmas in the mix. So part of the work of spiritual practice is to increase the amount of virtuous dharmas that arise and decrease the amount of afflictive dharmas that arise. You know, eventually you want to get rid of all the obscurations of the negative emotions. So part of the work is rooting out these negative emotions and substituting positive emotions for them. And all that is the purvey of the fourth skanda.
Okay. Question. This could be very basic. And just started cranky. What's the difference between dharma with a small d and the dharma with a big d?
Yeah, there's a difference. And in the Sanskrit, they're the same, so you have to figure out which is which. But in English, we capitalize dharma when it means the teachings, or when it means that which maintains the universe. That root dhr means to hold up or maintain. So the dharmas, small d, maintain the present moment. And the dharma, the big D, is the teachings about the way things are.
Teachings. Body of,
yeah.
Of the whole body of teachings.
Right.
The small d is.
Are the instantaneous experiences. Instantaneous phenomena, excuse me.
Okay, instantaneous phenomena. How is that different from an impulse?
Impulses are some kinds of instantaneous phenomena.
Oh, okay.
There are about 75 of them total, and about 50 of them are in the fourth skanda, in the impulses.
Okay, so once again, the words you word, they were spontaneous... What?
Phenomena.
Phenomena, so just spontaneous phenomena arising in the mind, or...
In the mind, in the moment.
In the moment, arising in the moment.
Yeah, it's the structure is a little bit complicated, but once you get onto it, it's fairly straightforward.
So Bob, on the little d dharma, the spontaneous moments are internal events. I thought they were also just like a moment of time.
They condition a moment of time. A moment of time has any number of dharmas in it.
Okay.
So these dharmas combine. I call that molecules of experience.
Mm-hmm.
If the dharmas are atoms of experience. It's a rough analogy, but it works okay. If the dharmas are atoms of experience, then the moments are molecules of experience. And that analogy does go a fair ways. Okay, then during the second turning, after the Prajnaparamita had begun to be expressed, Nagarjuna came along and put the same teaching of emptiness into strict logic. The Prajnaparamita is illogical and unplayful, or rather it oscillates between logic and illogic, or logic and that which is transcendent to logic. But with Nagarjuna, he uses logic to destroy logic, rather than playfulness to destroy logic. So it's a little bit drier of a study. Nagarjuna was followed by Chandrakirti a generation later, who codified and commented on Nagarjuna's work. And again, the effect of Nagarjuna's work is also to arrive at emptiness, and to hopefully arrive at the experience of emptiness as well as the concept of emptiness. But what it is the concept of emptiness gets subtler and subtler until there's nothing left. And then a direct experience of emptiness is possible.
So if you had to summarize what emptiness means, it, at least on a very basic level, it means any phenomena, any object, any phenomena is free of any qualities. There are no qualities.
Yes, no qualities. It means that the individual phenomena are empty of any intrinsic lasting nature. They have no own being, they have no essential nature. So emptiness is always empty of something. And a synonym, oddly enough, is fullness. Because at that level of subtlety, fullness and emptiness are the same thing. It's a matter of everything being totally interdependent with everything else. So you can't separate out anything because it's all one thing. And then the corollary is our illusions are also not real. They're just part of the cause and effect nature of the totality. So we have this illusion of being a separate self, but it's only an illusion. Actually, our separate selves don't exist. All that exists is that one fullness, that one emptiness.
So, Bob, are there like two ways into this? One is the interconnectedness way of like starting to perceive it, and the other one is like the one of it not having any individual qualities that they... For me, the interdependent one, it's easier for me to enter that way, to start to understand it that way.
Oh, than to see there are no qualities.
Pardon me?
To see that there are no qualities.
And so that's they're really almost the same thing then. That
yes.
Not independent of each other. And then plus that is so if they're not independent, to me it almost... I visualize something that is like one large thing, but then does the other part say that that large thing that I'm imagining doesn't have qualities and maybe doesn't exist?
Possibly.
It has no permanent quality.
Yes.
It has no permanent nature.
Yes.
But so it may have qualities.
Well, the emptiness, the concept of emptiness is designed to reduce any illusory qualities we may ascribe to something. So when they say that these phenomena have no characteristics, it's a way of breaking through all the conceptual apparatus behind isolating a phenomenon from the entirety. And what the entirety is a mystery. You know, what the emptiness is ultimately a mystery, though they say it can be experienced. And oddly enough, there's a parallel in the Christian mysticism, for instance, where it's said that it's possible to achieve union with God. And union with God is the equivalent of the realization of emptiness or fullness. But the run-of-the-mill mainstream religions don't have that concept or that path available. It's only the mystics and the in the case of Islam, the Sufis. So the inner circle of various religions does have that possibility of arriving at a cognition of the fullness, whatever it is, the cognition of the emptiness.
And what is the word for that in, what would be the Buddhist word for that experience of the recognition of the fullness?
Realization of emptiness. Yeah. And that's a distant goal, but it's worth striving for, and there are progresses along the way.
May I just comment on lines I particularly like?
Go ahead.
The hyperbolic exaggerations of the Mahayana appear throughout. This is part of the thing, in the line before that too. It's the perfect wisdoms are playfully illogical, and through that they arise at emptiness.
Yeah.
Because that's it. You can beat your brain on these things.
Yeah.
But you can. It also needs to be playful at a certain stage. It's, well, emptiness is beyond seriousness.
Yes, definitely.
Exactly.
It's neither serious nor non-serious.
One of the things I read is the hyperbolic exaggeration of the Mahayana. You know, they do exaggerate so much. I'm really beginning to understand that. I had mentioned before, like the 37 things we're doing. It's like they're beating me over the head with this stuff. But to me, then I understand that I'm learning to understand that's the hyperbolic exaggeration.
Yeah, they're trying to.
It finally gets through after enough.
Deconstruct the concept.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know, what's hyperbolic mean?
It's like. It's a mathematical form where the curve gets closer and closer to a line but never reaches it and goes off into an infinity.
So is it, to a certain extent, it means exaggerated too?
In this usage, yeah.
Yeah, in this usage.
Because it goes on to infinity and never reaches the point.
Which is
never reaches the line.
Exaggeration beyond,
An example.
There we go. Thank you.
An example of this comes from the Diamond Sutra. I can paraphrase it. It's if a bodhisattva were to fill the entire 1,000 great 1,000 world systems all with huge offerings, heaps of incense, all these offerings, the fine goods that they offer to the Buddhas, all of that would generate a huge heap of merit.
Mm-hmm.
But that heap of merit is not 1/10,000th part, not 100,000th part of the heap of merit generated by adhering to the perfect wisdom and explicating even one single four-line stanza of the good Dharma. Now that's absurd.
Exactly.
And it's intentionally absurd.
Hyperbolic exaggeration.
Yeah. So hyperbolic exaggeration is as good a way to describe it as any.
That's interesting.
Playfully illogical. We've got to keep that in mind when we get
fabulous, isn't it?
Too stuck.
Yeah.
Now, the example that I used in the handout was illustrating the concept of emptiness. The concept of emptiness as a pot and all its interconnections with its production and its existence. but let's try a different one. Let's try the chariot. The chariot has wheels, it has a frame, it has a door for the passenger to sit in, it has a seat for the driver, it has reins connecting to the horse and carriage, transport people from one place to another. Now, the driver is a symbol of the thinking mind, the horse is a symbol of the feeling mind, and the chariot is a symbol of the body. But if you look in detail at the chariot, it doesn't exist. There's a heap of parts. You can see a wheel, but the wheel is not the chariot. The spokes of the wheel, the hub of the wheel, that's not the wheel, that's not the chariot. And by the time you've deconstructed the whole thing, there's no chariot. So similarly with all phenomena, by deconstructing them, you arrive at emptiness, which is that no concept will cover the ground.
Just something like the Hindu story of the elephant.
Oh, yeah, the elephant and the blind man,
yes,
that story.
Exactly, kind of a similar type.
Similar type. The fullness is like that.
Right.
It looks different from different perspectives, but it's actually only one thing.
Right.
And of course, the blind people misconstrue it.
Exactly, just what they can everything, which is not true. It's just a part. Like you say, like the chariot is just, each thing is just a
Yeah,
part.
They feel the ear and they think the elephant is like a fan. They
right.
feel the leg, and they think the elephant is like a column, and so on. Meanwhile, these sutras are written in the form of dialogues. And that's true of most, or of many philosophical works, even in the West. For instance, the dialogues of Plato express this philosophy of Socrates from Plato's perspective. Most of the Stoic works are dialogues. The great Parmenides poem is a description of an encounter with a goddess who shows Parmenides the fullness. Galileo wrote his scientific works as a dialogue. And recently, the theoretical work of Gregory Bateson, he wrote Steps to an Ecology of Mind, which is a dialogue between him and his daughter, you know, about the nature of reality. So that kind of form is conducive to the expression of ideas, because you get a back and forth, you get a two perspectives, or two versions of the same thing. I get a little parallax in there. And in the case of the Perfect Wisdom Sutras, the disciple most often mentioned is Shariputra. So it's dialogues between the Buddha and Shariputra, or in the case of the Heart Sutra, between Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra. And one of the beings in the dialogue represents a full understanding of whatever's being taught, and the other is the learner. Now, Shariputra was the wisest of all of Buddha's direct disciples, so he perfectly understood the Abhidharma. You know, he had widely practiced what the Shakyamuni Buddha taught. But the Mahayana perspective is that he did not know about the emptiness of phenomena. He knew about the emptiness of ego. He knew about the skandhas, but he thought the skandhas were real because that's what Abhidharma teaches. So the interaction between the Buddha and Shariputra or Avalokita and Shariputra makes Shariputra the learner and the Buddha or Avalokita the teacher. And they're all one field. You can't have the one without the other. So the result is the Dharma is arrived at through that dialogue between the two. The Diamond Sutra, on the other hand, is a dialogue between Subhuti and the Buddha. And Subhuti represents the most advanced disciple in emptiness. In other words, he understands emptiness pretty well. So the dialogue with Subhuti gets into the fine points and the subtleties of the doctrine of emptiness. Because Subhuti already understands quite a bit. So in a way, the Heart Sutra is more accessible. The Diamond Sutra we'll be working on next month. But what I've decided to do is have a reading circle, let the sutra speak for itself, and we'll just read it out loud and pass the book. Hopefully people bring their books. And read the boldface type. And read the commentaries on your own. But my experience is reading these sutras out loud is really beneficial.
Who's the author of that book? Does it matter?
Unknown. It's said to be the word of the Buddha.
Okay, no, I meant the book for class.
Oh, that's the Kanzi book.
What is it?
Edward Kanzi, he translated it in that book called Buddhist Wisdom.
It's called Buddhist Wisdom?
Yeah, the Diamond and Heart Sutra. Yeah, be sure and bring them next month if you come. anyway, Subhuti understands a lot, and the dialogue between Subhuti and the Buddha is quite snappy. And it goes all the way out there somewhere. And then the big sutra, the 25,000 line, the 100,000 line, has many dialogues in it. The Buddha with Subhuti, the Buddha with the god Indra is in the middle of the sutra, the big sutra. And the big sutra, the 25,000 line sutra is a summary of the 100,000 line one. And the 100,000 line one, for instance, it makes a statement of, like, form is emptiness because it has no essential nature. And then it goes through 200 items repeating the same thing. I saw a Chinese copy of this, and it was like that much on a shelf. Bound volumes, pretty big print. And I stumbled across that set of 200 items. And page after page it went, feeling is empty, tsushing kungu, because its essential nature is empty. And then perception is empty, tsushing kungu, because its essential nature is empty. And page after page of tsushing kungu. If you repeat that by chanting, it sinks in deeper. In fact, I tried chanting the 25,000 line sutra. You know, I'd read a page of it every day, and it worked pretty well. It didn't sink in deep enough, though. I should do it again. And I would advise, if you're there for the reading of the Heart Sutra, then try chanting it aloud on your own a few times, every once in a while. Sutras are very funny. They open up sometimes. And they're not always accessible because of our crazy minds. But when a sutra opens up, work with it.
And so this is the whole Heart Sutra.
Yes.
Every word of what we're reading here
is the Heart Sutra.
The entirety of the Heart Sutra.
Yeah. And the sutra is intended to be a summary of the basic doctrines of emptiness in the Perfect Wisdom. Mm-hmm. And it does a marvelous job of summarizing everything. Then there's a book out there of the short Prajnaparamita Sutras, which is very lovely. And it's got the 700 line sutra in it, the 500 line, the 50 line, the sutra on the king who guards his country, the sutra on the questions of this or that person, usually a king. The Perfection of Wisdom in a Few Words. And one of my favorites, the Perfection of Wisdom in One Letter. And the Perfection of Wisdom in One Letter goes, receive, O Ananda, for the benefit of all beings, the Perfection of Wisdom in One Letter. Ah. And, you know, that's either a joke, which it is, or something really profound, which it is, because ah is the source of all letters, and letters are the source of all words, and words are the source of all statements, and the statements are the source of all conceptual dharmas. So you're getting right to the root when you go with just ah. And ah is, of course, surrounded by the ground of blank paper. And there's an interaction between figure and ground. There's one book that's even profounder than the Perfection of Wisdom in One Letter. And that's a secret book that was circulated in the Middle East in the medieval times. And this book had a huge reputation. It was said that you could understand the entire creation with this book, the entire way that the world works with this book. And, of course, people sought it madly, and it was very hard to locate. And there are various stories about the adventures people had looking for this book. And then it talked about one person who actually found it, opened it up. It was totally blank. And that's the way the world works. So meanwhile, we got dialogues, we got emptiness.
We need to republish that book. See if we can get it on the New York Times
bestseller. Yes. Yeah, Idris Shah published a version of that, but it may or may not be out of print. It doesn't use much ink. It has a title page and some stories of the search for the book and then the book itself, which is a couple hundred blank pages.
Too late, it's already been done.
It's already been done, yep. Okay, one other point and then we'll go, two other points. One is that very often the meaning of the Wisdom Sutras is expressed in a metaphor. The pot, they don't use the chariot, but the Upanishads use the chariot. The pot, there's a passage in the Diamond Sutra that said, the Dharma is said to be like unto a raft with a secret meaning. And then the commentaries explain the meaning. The raft is what you use to cross the river of suffering. So to cross the river of suffering, you need a vehicle of some sort. And once you reach the other shore of nirvana, of total peace, then you don't need the raft anymore. You know, it would be silly to carry the raft around on your back as you're exploring the landscape of nirvana, whatever that might be like. And then there's another wrinkle, too. You can always take the raft back across the river of suffering and bring other people across. You know, that's the bodhisattva style. And then the arhats just go off into nirvana.
Again, here the Dharma is the capital D, so it means the teaching.
Yes,
itself.
Exactly. That's the capital
the
D. Yeah, very useful, the capital letter in that case. So the other shore is a state of peace and compassion. And the Dharma is to be abandoned at the end. Because there's a certain point where the very Dharma becomes an obstacle to the realization of emptiness. You know, because we've got a construct here. The Dharma is as much a construct as war and peace. And it's built for a purpose. The purpose is to guide sentient beings away from their suffering and occlusion and ignorance into the light of reality. So that's the purpose of the structure, but you get to the place where the structure is getting subtler and subtler, and you discover you don't need it anymore. You know, what you need is the real experience of what's being talked about. So you set the Dharma aside, you set the raft aside. Now there's a famous four-line stanza in the Diamond Sutra after it carries on about maintaining and explicating and writing out and copying. Even one four-line stanza of the Dharma is worth a huge heap of merit. So the example four-line stanza that they express, I've got a paraphrase of it here. All compounded things are like a dream, a magic show. They are like a lamp, like stars, like distorted vision, a phantom, a dewdrop in the sunlight. They are like a lightning flash in a cloud. That is how to observe them. That is how to meditate on them. And that'll do as a paraphrase. There's some other similes in there that I left out. Like a bubble is one. Like a distorted vision. Oh, I've got that, yeah. Basically, a dream, when you awaken, doesn't seem real. And likewise, our illusions of a life doesn't seem real when we awaken. A lamp, now in those days, lamps were open flames with maybe glass around them. And a lamp sheds light until it runs out of fuel. Or the wind could blow it out. So conditioned things, in other words, our experience is like that lamp. It flickers for a while and then it goes out. Stars, they're distant, and there are many of them. Likewise, our dreams are distant, and there are many of them. Distorted vision is like trying to see something with a cataract. You know, the cataract distorts the field of vision. And likewise, our life in the conditioned world, in the compounded world, is like a distorted vision. A phantom, a dewdrop in the sunlight. Actually, it doesn't say sunlight, but a dewdrop. And a dewdrop evaporates. So it's there, and then it's gone. Just as our lives are there for a while, and then they're gone. And that's the nature of samsara. That's the nature of compounded things. Lightning flash in a cloud, I like that one. Because and people say that when they get near the end of their lives, the experience constantly speeds up and speeds up and speeds up, and pretty soon it's just like the whole life was a lightning flash and it's over. So these metaphors are very precise in a way. You know, they point to real things, real experiences. We're done with what I got, so we can do some more questions, and I'll shut this thing down.